Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to her, is Heidi E. Y. Stempel, author of almost 50 books and numerous stories and poems, mostly for young readers. But what we're talking about tonight is something unique that she has recently written and has just been published. We're talking about her new book, The Poetry of Car Mechanics. Heidi, welcome to the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, especially about a book like this.
It's a little different than the books you're used to.
Jesus. Well, that's an understatement. I had no idea that you were... Now, had you done anything like this before?
I have written for different ages. I've written a bunch of short stories for middle graders. But honestly, I always said, and I think maybe many writers say this, when I was asked by a friend who's an editor, Eileen Robinson, who is the head of Moves at Charles Bridge House, they did not publish it. I did not wind up selling this to Eileen, but she said to me, Heidi, I need you to write me a boy book. And I'm going to use air quotes here. I know you can't see me. I said to her, I don't really write boy books. And she said, I need it to be a novel. And I said, I definitely don't have a novel in me. No way, not writing a novel.
Oh, my God.
And then I thought, well, I'm going to have to come up with, just to show her that I can't do it, I'm going to, what would the manliest, like, hilarious, right? And this book winds up being a lot about masculinity, so it was funny that it started this way. I thought, okay, I've always wanted to write a verse novel, although I'm definitely not ever doing that, but I would call it The Poetry of Car Mechanics, and that is the title of the book.
Right.
But so once I had a title, and I almost never start with a title. The title for me is marketing. It comes later. But in this case, it came first from sort of a dare, an assignment. And then I sat down and wrote 19 poems. And for me, the beginning of any story is about character and mood and setting, and that's really what I did. And I was at a writer's retreat with a friend of mine, Casey, who is named in the acknowledgments because this book would have never happened without her. Some books just have a first reader. Every poem she's read, every poem she has discussed with me. But we were there together, and I remember, she remembers, she always tells me this, that we walked out of our cabins to go meet for lunch, and I said to her, well, looks like I'm writing a verse novel.
Well, okay. Can I just digress there at the minute? Is this a thing? I've never read a verse novel. But is this a form that exists and a lot of people do it?
It is. Well, I mean, think of Shakespeare, right? What are you reading? A novel in verse.
A play. I'm reading a play. This is totally different.
So novels in verse have been around a long time. We really, in children's literature, credit we talk about it a lot. Sharon Creech did Love That Dog, Love This Dog, brilliant. And it's telling a story. Instead of telling it in prose and filling in all of what is being said, it is telling the story in a series of poems. Now, some verse novels are a bit more broken line prose, and there's a very good reason for that. It is a really wonderful way of telling a story because you got to get a lot of plot in there as well.
Yeah.
But for me, mine is a little bit more of using the poetic form, using metaphor, using simile, pulling back a little from the details of the things that are going on, to a little more of an introspective look. And in my case, it's first person. The main character's name is Dylan Thomas Jude, named for a poet. Mm-hmm. And he is a kid who writes poetry. So it's all in his voice and his poems and talking about the story that is unfolding in this book using his words.
And I want to say that every poem has got a title.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about... one or two pages long, long. But so when I first opened the book and looked, I thought, how is this going to read? In other words, how am I going to actually enjoy this? And the amazing thing is, after the first few pages, it just became a new form that I was reading something in, and that's how well it's done. I don't mean to just blow smoke on you, but it was amazing to me about how well you did this.
Thank you.
So this is your first attempt out of the shoot there?
Yes, though to be fair, I have some poetry collections that my
I knew you've written short stories and you've written poetry, but this is a different animal. I mean, this, you know, it's like certs is a candy mint, certs is a breath mint. I mean, you just sort of combine these two things, and it's a different kind of reading experience for the reader, and I found that enjoyable. But then you get lost in the story. I mean, very soon you lose sight of the fact that you're reading a unique form. And the story, this is the other thing. I could see writing something like this in a humorous vein. It would be very easy to do. But this is a deadly serious story.
And it encompasses a lot of themes. And I don't know that I'm not somebody who plots a story really tightly.
Well, that was my next question, is how do you plan this out?
I fly into the mist, as my mom likes to call it. I sat down.
Why am I not surprised?
Okay. Yeah, so I let the character sort of tell me what's going on.
Okay.
Some of the plot lines were woven in after. The first draft of this was 101 poems. I thought that was a wonderful number, and I sent it to my agent, and she said, more.
Wow.
And it wound up, it's around, I don't know, I haven't counted them in a while, but it's approximately 200 poems. But the interesting thing about a verse novel, I believe, and I feel this way about poetry in general, which is it doesn't matter what the poet puts in, it matters what the reader takes out.
Right.
So all that white space around a poem, all that area that I have not filled in with every detail of a scene, that is asking the reader to create that scene from their own experiences. I say we've walked out to a stream and sat on a log or on a rock, but this is something that this character does. I have not described the trees. I have not described the walk so much. I have not described what the grass looks like. So the reader is really asked to bring themselves to that part of the
story. I had a definite vision of that spot.
Yes, but I didn't create it. You did.
Right.
And that's the blank space in a poem. And I think that is what you're responding to when you say, I looked at it and I was like, how am I going to read this? And then you brought yourself to it.
It's amazing. Let's talk about the main characters.
Okay.
Let's talk about Dylan. I mean, it's a kid who's having an extremely tough time.
But Dylan is definitely having an extremely tough time, and it started out, and this is one of the strongest themes in the book, and it began in the early presidency of that guy that we've got back. Now, we were hopeful that when the book was published, the kids reading it wouldn't even understand what that problem was.
Fat chance.
And
Don't get started.
Well, we brought the politics local.
Yeah. What was amazing is how contemporary this book has become because of those politics.
Yeah. So I was grappling.
Hello?
And still is. But yeah. I think that first presidency really had us thinking, how is it that we can still hold on to relationships with people that we love, family members,
right,
people we have to work with, if they are so diametrically opposite from us? So how are the kids just looking at the adults in their lives? Because kids don't have the choice to say, my politics are different from yours, I'm no longer speaking to you. Kids are in the home with parents, or in this case, Pops. Pops is his custodial parent. Paternal grandfather, but is grappling with, how is it possible to live with Pop? All of a sudden, has always been a gruff, rough guy, but as Dylan has grown, Pops has really become sort of radicalized by the news and by his own politics. And
to the point where his coworker leaves.
Yeah, and his coworker Larry, who is everybody's favorite in the book, leaves because of this anti-immigrant sentiment that has come up. And Larry had always sort of sparred with Pops on politics, as some people feel confident enough doing. And I think that Larry really identity until it got too far for him. And Larry's just like, nope, not anymore. Can't do this.
Wow.
Leaving Dylan very much alone with Pop. Dylan's mom was already gone.
Now, this is the other. I mean, okay, Pop's a car garage, a repair shop. And we'll talk about that metaphor in just a second. But his mother, it's something like I very much identified with. And I'm just going to leave that out there.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think that almost everybody who's read it has said that to me. I identify with this. I don't want to talk about my own life, but this really, I felt really heard and seen reading this.
Well, and especially at that age, I mean, mm-hmm. that the Dylan is, you have this thing where it's a medical problem, but mm-hmm. the way that it manifests itself puts you in sometimes deeply embarrassing and sort of, and you can't deal with it. I mean, there's no dealing with that. And his mother is bipolar, but she just has these extremes of behavior that she often manifests. Like there was a scene at the library.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you really feel for Dylan. You also feel for her. And as you clearly point out in the afterwards, you know, she's not a villain. Mm-hmm. She's a person who's got a medical problem.
Yeah. The complicated part about writing a story where the offstage character, because Catherine Jude, Dylan's mom, is not in the story. She is gone already by the time the story starts. But a lot of the story is Dylan having flashbacks and sort of putting together his feelings about loss of his mother, who, as you said, suffers from bipolar disorder. So the of writing this story was to make sure she's not the bad guy, because in no way is she the villain of this, but also to allow Dylan to have his feelings about that. Dylan's feelings were not my feelings about it, but he was in the middle of it, and he was allowed to feel angry. He was allowed to feel embarrassed, and he was allowed to feel abandoned. So all of those things had to be able to come through in the book without villainizing, because also I'm the author, so I do get to have some say in how it's written. And my agent and I did a lot of back and forth making sure Dylan was allowed to feel his feelings and also that it was sensitive to this offstage character. And until I felt that every single word, any ableist term that Dylan used, I felt was correct for what his character would say. We did not send it to editors until I felt I could use that word on purpose because Dylan authentically felt. And that was important to me. And we thing love about writing for kids is we writers are so introspective of this balance, of this sensitivity, that I think for the most part, children's literature gets it right because we work so, so, so hard at it. I hope that shines through.
That did.
Starting from the beginning.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to her, is Heidi E.Y. Stempel, author of almost 50 books and numerous stories and poems, mostly for young readers. But we're talking about her new book, which is a horse of another color, as they said in The Wizard of Oz, The Poetry of Car Mechanics. It's a really interesting, deep book. Heidi, did you... some of this reads so deep and true. Did you involve a lot of people, at least experiences that you had with other people, into this writing?
Yeah.
I figured that.
I say in the back of the book that I wrote this book as truthfully as I could about characters who are completely made up. However, I also come to it from a deep understanding as someone who has been in the middle of a storm that is similar to the storm that Dylan is in. And I use storm as a metaphor a lot in the book, for actual storms and for emotional storms and storms that are kicked up by his mom. I truly tried to use the emotional experiences that I have in my life, but there's also experiences that happened early in the book. You know, we had to have something that started the action, and Dylan walks out into by a stream behind the auto shop, and he spots an injured hawk. Now, I actually had this happen to me, and what I heard was the crows and the blue jays screaming, and I thought, oh, predator. I knew it was a predator, because as Dylan says, which is something that I always say, is that a crow signaling predator still raises the hairs on
right.
the back of our
oh,
neck.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Reminding us that we are human after all. And in the case of me in my backyard, I looked up for a hawk, and what happened was a bobcat walked out. So I was looking up, and the bobcat came out low. And that was the first scene that I wrote, and then I realized I have no need to write a bobcat book, but I'd really love to write another bird book, you know, because that's my thing. And
this is certainly a bird book, too.
It is, and I love the bird connections. In fact, I'd written the whole thing, and I needed to make sure that the bird stuff was correct, the raptor rehabilitation stuff was correct.
Well, that was the most transparent. It was funny. As soon as I read about Tom Rodriguez, the raptor rehabilitator, I knew, Tom Riccardi, yeah.
You knew.
But what a great part of that book. And what's fascinating for me is the connection you make between car repair. This is going to sound frivolous, but it's not. And bird repair. Because that idea that you can fix it, that you can make it better, it may not be perfect, but you can make it better, is such an important theme of your book for Dylan. The fact that you can do something sometimes about stuff and make it better.
And sometimes things don't need to be fixed.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you can't fix things, but also sometimes things are that look broken are just fine. So all of the car mechanic stuff, which, by the way, I had a really good team of.
I was going to ask you, are you that good at car repair?
No. And I got all of it wrong when I wrote it. And I would text my partner, Dennis, and I'd be like, what do you do when you change oil? He would send me stuff, and it would go right into the poem. I'm like, but that word's not very poetic. What other things are you using? And then when he was not available, because he's just retired, but he was a teacher, so sometimes when I was working on a revision, he wasn't available, I would text his friend Len Beeman, and Len would give me some of the words. So all of the poetry car mechanics was vetted by Dennis and Len. It was 100% not me.
Man. Hey, I'm going to ask, could you read one of the poems?
I certainly can. Would you like to go bird? Would you like to go politics?
Where do you think birds over politics? That's my motto for this next couple of years.
All right. I'm going to read kind of a sad poem, which is hilarious, but, and it tells you a little bit about who Dylan is and a little bit about Pops and a little bit about his mom. And it is called A Bird in the Hand. And by the way, some Baltimore Orioles, which are now not called Baltimore Orioles anymore, are they called American Orioles, are over my head squawking and fighting. So if you can hear that, there's two men fighting over territory. They're gorgeous. This is about waxwings, though. A bird in the hand. Once, when I was smaller, a flock of waxwings collided with the kitchen window. Three flew off, stunned, leaving one at lawn's edge. I picked it up, willed it to fly, willed its little heart to keep beating, beating, beating. My tears rained onto its limp body as it died in the soft nest of my cupped hands. I wanted to have a funeral like Mom would have done if she were there, which she was not. But Pops thought it too sentimental. Boys, he told me for the 100th, 1,000,000th, 1,000,000,000th time, don't cry, especially for dead birds. In secret, I wrote a poem and dug a small grave, burying the bird, my words, and all my tears under a rock and a pile of leaves in my secret place where the blue heron hunts.
That is such a, on its own, that's a wonderful poem.
I know, and then it's part of the narrative. That
I know that. I read the book.
I love that about verse novels.
The first thing I thought of is this would make a great animation from Japan.
Oh, okay. From your mouth to the animation god's ears.
But, I mean, it would be one of those sort of very, Miyazaki, I think, does those really incredible, meaningful animations.
Well, if you call them, I'll sign
right, I'll be right on that. Check, checks in the mail. we're laughing about this, but this is such a tender and meaningful book. And what's fascinating about it to me is how this whole thing's story just sort of blends together and has a wonderful beginning, middle, and end. And I can't believe you didn't blot this out. I'm still trying to come to grips with that. That's just amazing. You're definitely, you live a magical life for that to be able to happen.
As writers, we talk about being of two sorts. There's the plotters, people who plot everything out, and the pantsers. That's those of us who fly by the seat of our pants. And I'm actually working on a novel right now, and I'm about a third of the way through it.
Okay.
And I know what's going to happen, but I don't hold too tightly to it. And here's why. Because by the time I write up to it, my characters are different. They've told me more things about themselves. They are not a narrow character that I've just created. They have rounded themselves out. So they might make different decisions at the end when they're winding their way out of the trouble that they've gotten themselves into, right? So if I hold too tightly to what I was sure the ending was going to be, or I'm sure what the solution was going to be, those being two different things, right? I might miss some of the magical beauty that is storytelling. And I know that sounds a little woo-woo, but I stand by it. I get it.
Heidi, I understand this.
In control. Yeah.
I can't do it, but I understand it. When you come to those moments, do you emotionally recognize that wow, this is something that the characters revealed to me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Sometimes you just feel like a conduit. It's like the characters are just using my hands to type things out. And again, I am not a spiritual person in any way, shape, or form, but I know there's this one piece of magic in storytelling that I teach writing all the time. I can't teach that.
Yeah.
That you have or you don't have. I can teach you to write a very competent narrative, but if you don't feel that bit of magic, your story is going to lack that bit of magic. So, you know, here's where we are.
One of the other great themes of this book is defining manhood, because that's a huge struggle for him, too. You talked about Boys Don't Cry. I think that was a Cure song, wasn't it? The Cure?
I think it's also a movie.
Oh, okay. But that's again, it was really well handled and, again, very convincing. That's why I didn't want this book to sort of end. I wanted to follow him through into adulthood, sort of like a John Updike kind of a thing. It was really, really impressive. Now, you mentioned in the end writing, the Highlights Foundation Retreat Center.
I swear by them.
Now, I'm going to ask a dumb question, but that wasn't like Highlights, the magazine that's in the dentist office, is it?
It is indeed.
Oh, my God.
I know. Isn't that fun? So, okay, Highlights has several arms. It's the Myers-Brown family, and George Brown, who runs the foundation, the retreat center, which is a nonprofit, and there's a firewall between that and the magazine and the publishing arm. So those are very separate things, but they are run by the same foundation and family.
Wow.
And so the Highlights Foundation is a campus where there's a barn where we eat all of our meals. There's a lodge where you can stay in and has big open spaces, and there are cabins. And I love to write in the cabins. And I began this book in the cabins. I reviewed this book in the cabins, in different cabins, as a matter of fact. I teach there a lot. I'm teaching 3 courses this summer there. And you can go either to learn things from these classes that lots of us teach, or you can go just for a private retreat where you get fed, all your needs
are met,
and you just have the time to write. So I get up at 5:00 in the morning and I write till 5 p.m.
We're going to have to end it there. I'm just glad that the people who put out Goofus and Gallant are still in the still working.
Absolutely.
My returning guest tonight is Heidi E.Y. Stemple, author of almost 50 books, countless numerous stories, poems, and now a poetic novel. We're talking about her new book, The Poetry of Car Mechanics, and trust me, it really is a worthwhile reading experience. It's wonderful. Heidi, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for saying such nice things about this book.
Hey,
I am
you
so
wrote the
proud
book.
Of.
I just had the pleasure of reading it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.